Group meeting, Saturday, 26th July, 1986. We have now come nearly to the end of the fourth chapter, the injunction and the mandate. The injunction against giving the sacred teaching to those who are not fit, to those who have not devotion, and so forth. There is one particular sentence here which I should like to read before we proceed to the mandate. You know how Jesus said, "Suffer little children, allow little children, and forbid them not to come unto me, for such is the kingdom of heaven." Several centuries, almost a millennium before the birth of Jesus, Yajnavalkya was one of the greatest of the Upanishadic teachers. And he taught, "Let a Brahman, having shaken free of the burden of book knowledge, choose to live as a child. When he becomes free of both learning and childlikeness, he becomes the silent one. Shaking free of both sound and silence, he becomes a Brahman." That is an extraordinarily inclusive statement. Becoming as a little child implies first and foremost the simple fact that he who lives the religious life sensibly, intelligently, becomes perfectly innocent in his mind. It is the innocence which is stressed. And innocence, as you know, one meaning, of course, is not knowing. But the deep meaning is not harming. He has become the harmless one. That's what is the real meaning of the child. And of course, we know, as a matter of fact, that the very little child is a harmless creature. And what's more, it is completely unable to be deliberately hurtful. It reacts angrily at certain things, but then that is its inheritance through its animal descent. That can't be helped at all. But there is no deliberate intention or planning to hurt on the part of the child. So, let him choose to live as a child. When he becomes free of both learning and childlikeness, he becomes the silent one. Learning has its place, it has its uses, and actually it is indispensable in our life, any sort of life, whether it be specifically the religious life or the secular life in the usual way. But learning always conditions us, and it conditions our mode of understanding. This is where the great difficulty comes. With learning, we learn this, that, and the other, and the brain is taught to interpret and understand all that comes in our life just only in those terms. And this is why learning is a hindrance often. Often and often it is a great hindrance. Also, one of the great difficulties with learning is that it leads to intellectual pride, just as we have social pride and we have spiritual pride. There is this intellectual pride. I know, you see, he's talking nonsense. Is he? He may be, of course. But the I know attitude is a very inhibiting attitude to life. One doesn't learn then. So he becomes the silent one. Now, what does this silence mean, particularly? It means, above all, the silence of the brain, in the sense that it does not react against any and every event or impression that comes through the senses to one. We have we all know very well from our own life experience how we say, oh, this is nonsense, this is no good, I don't like this, etc., etc., you see. So the brain becomes silent, and when the brain becomes silent and does not react against or for whatever impression comes to us, then one is still learning, one is free to learn. And in that learning, there is not only the growth of one's intellectual faculties, but also spiritual growth. Because one becomes more and more sensitive to all that life has to offer to us. And this is very, very important, this sensitivity. Because without this sensitivity, faculties and qualities like compassion cannot function quite freely. If I am insensitive, I am going to shrug my shoulders and say, oh, not my business. Or I might say, oh, serve him right. Why did he do this? Why does he live like that? That's what he deserves, and so forth. Quite true. It may be what he deserves according to the ordinary laws of the land, and so forth, and so forth. But all the same, it clamps down and prevents oneself being fully compassionate. One has to be compassionate to people who are, as we say, happy and enjoying themselves. And we have to be compassionate also to those who are unhappy and not enjoying themselves. Because pleasure always comes to an end. But the craving for pleasure and its repetition never seems to come to an end in the lives of the majority of human beings in the world. They want more and more of it, and so forth, you see. And they can't get hold of it. One of the great problems of old age, for instance, the things that the young body was capable of doing and enjoying and so forth, are no longer available to the old body. It can't do it. And the person in his mind doesn't like it. He cannot accept, he cannot understand that this is the way of the life of the organism, and so forth. So now, he becomes the silent one. Now, shaking free of both sound and silence. The word sound there means, of course, taught him or what is spoken to him as far as his spiritual life is concerned. Shakes free of it all. Now this to me is a point of supreme importance. I have said again and again, you remember, each and every one of us is transcendence embodied. It is transcendence, this primordial creative energy, which becomes you or me. You see? All right. And because the creativity of transcendence is endlessly original, the variety is absolutely immeasurable. Therefore, each one of us is unique. But we don't know our real uniqueness. And again, either circumstance or our personal desires go against our uniqueness. I can give you a personal example of that. As a very small child, it was my great desire to become a priest. You see, it was my natural inclination. I was just about 5 or 6, or maybe even less than that. But my mother told me that in our community, the Parsi community, the Zoroastrian community, you can't become a priest unless you are the son of a priest yourself. You have to be born into a priestly family. So you see, that was a great disappointment. And it certainly afflicted me, really afflicted me. Then later on, the idea was put into my head to become an Indian civil servant. You see, the Indian civil service was a very different thing from the civil service here. The Indian civil service meant that you went into along either the line of the judiciary, you became a magistrate, a judge, or something like that, you see. Or it went along the other line, the people who deal with government as such. And of course, you could climb to a very great height that way, in worldly terms. My father's cousin was the foremost barrister in India in the latter part of the last century and in the early part of this. He died in 1915. You see, he was famous all over the land. And he also played his part in the executive line. He was the very first person fearlessly to criticize the viceroy and the, not cabinet, what's it called there? I forget. And so forth. And he proved to be right in his criticisms, which of course didn't make him a favorite with government circles as such. But he was an extremely distinguished man, and my parents wanted to follow in his footsteps. My name, it was the same as his name was, you see, my personal name. And that was one idea. And the other was to become a barrister. Well, of course, Sir Firoz Shah was a barrister, essentially. But many members of my family have been distinguished in the legal sphere as such. So they wanted me to become that. And when I came to Cambridge, the idea was that I should also study the law, and I read natural sciences, because the number of marks allotted to science questions totted up to the 3,000 required for the Indian Civil Service. If you took other subjects, none of them added up to 3,000, but science did. Well, neither of those things came off. Absolutely didn't. I was very perturbed, very disturbed with the moral aspect of the law and so forth. And that is to say, the moral aspect in this sense, that if a barrister was clever enough, and my father's cousin was so clever that all the Maharajas always collared his services because they knew they'd get he'd get them off, you see, in his troubles with the government and so forth. Well, if a barrister was clever enough to win his case, knowing well that his client was in the wrong, where's the justice of it all? And that happens to this day, doesn't it? If your counsel is a real genius at his job, he'll get off a torque murder. And so forth. And I just couldn't stand it, that idea. And also certain things happened during those years, the 1921 to 1924, when people were hanged. There was this terrible case of a pantry boy called Jacoby at Ritz. It was, no, not at the Ritz. It was at that hotel in the Strand, next to near Charing Cross. What was it? What is it?
Savoy.
That's it, Savoy Hotel. He intended just to commit a little robbery from one of the residents, who was a rich, a very rich woman, you see. And the silly little fellow took a knife with him. He was only, well, I think he must have been 18, otherwise he couldn't have been hanged. She woke up, you see, and he absolutely lost his nerve and stabbed her. She died. He was hanged. A year or two later, a Mrs. Barney shot her lover, and she got off, because she used, so the story goes, she used £30,000. Well, now, things like that so revolted me that I wouldn't have anything to do with the law after that. And with the civil service too, it came to nothing. But let not this afternoon be a biographical show. But this is just to illustrate how sound and silence, you see, shaking free of sound and silence, he becomes a Brahman. Now, we come to the mandates. We considered the injunction last time against giving out esoteric knowledge. Sri Krishna says to Arjuna, this comes in the last discourse, the 18th discourse, verses 68 and 69. He who shall declare this supreme secret among my devotees, having shown the highest devotion to me, without doubt he shall come to me. Nor is there any among men who performeth dearer service to me than he, nor any shall be more beloved by me on earth than he. Now this I consider an unfortunate statement. The transcendence doesn't measure love. Krishna is regarded as God incarnate. I, as an ordinary father, as an ordinary man of the world, make no difference at all between the love given to my two sons and their children. You see? I mean, perfectly ridiculous. That which is love is immeasurable. You don't love one more than the other. No favoritism. So I think that part of the sentence is rather unfortunate. But considering that it belongs to pre-Buddhistic times, that's 2,700 or 800 years ago, you see, the author of the Gita may have slipped. He didn't come to our group meetings first. Zarathustra declares, "He who expounds to the wise the mantra, the holy word, is indeed blessed." The Buddha says to his first 60 perfected ones, "Walk, monks, on tour for the blessing of the many folk, for the happiness of the many folk, out of compassion for the world, for the welfare, for the blessing, the happiness of gods and men." This he says at the beginning of his ministry. And his ministry lasted 45 years. And at the end, shortly before his death, he says, "Therefore, monks, ye to whom the truths I have perceived have been made known by me, having thoroughly made yourselves masters of them, practice them, meditate upon them, and spread them abroad, in order that pure religion may last long and be perpetuated, in order that it may continue to be for the good and happiness of the great multitudes, out of pity for the world, to the good and the gain and the well-will of gods and men." He of course used the word devas. But the word deva is not properly understood. That's why I say gods in this case. Now, there you see a marvelous statement again. "Having made yourselves thorough masters of them, of the teachings, meditate upon them." Now, meditate does not mean musing, giving inaudible lectures with your brain. Those are just verbal rituals, if you like. That is not meditation. The meditative state is entered when the brain has been silenced. Then, because the brain gets silenced only through the complete purification of the whole psyche, then pure mind, which is a mode of functioning of the primordial creative energy of transcendence itself, that is what mind actually is. Mind functions through that pure, empty, transparent psyche, empty of all ill, also of all relative good as we in the world know it. You see? So in that state of complete silence of the brain, the state of perfect peace, you are in communion, you are in unity actually with transcendence. And then things happen. What happens, I can't tell you. But it so impresses the organism that later on it may emerge as certain profound perceptions, ideas, and the appropriate words to express them. Because words can be so inadequate and so misleading. So one has to be extremely careful. Then what you say is inspired speech. It is prophetic. It's prophetic speech. Prophetic speech has nothing to do with telling you what's going to happen at Ascot next year. Nothing like that. This is prophetic speech. And because it is prophetic speech, it has such a tremendous spiritual power associated with it that it awakens the listener or the reader. It awakens him or her to something which he or she had not previously experienced. That is meditation. Now, the living Jesus, whilst he was alive, the Son of Man, says to his 12 apostles before sending them forth, "Go not into the way of the Gentiles, and into any city of the Samaritans enter ye not, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And as ye go, preach, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand." Some translate it as "at hand," others translate it, "the kingdom of heaven is within you." "Heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out devils. Freely ye have received, freely give." Freely ye have received, freely give. Do the organized churches of the world freely give? Now this statement, "heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out devils." The miracles of Jesus are believed literally. Healing of the blind man and so forth and so forth. But this very idea is in the Atharva Veda, which belongs to 1000 AD in India, you see. Healing the sick. And it's sick in soul. It hasn't got anything to do with the body, really. It may have something to do with the body. It could have under certain circumstances. You know how in the Gospels it is said that Peter pulled out his sword and cut off the ear of one of the chappies, and Jesus put the ear back. Now, do you think that happened literally? Utterly impossible. And a perfected holy one like Jesus would not do that sort of thing. Putting the ear back, what does it mean? The ear is the instrument of hearing. It's the apparatus through which you hear, through which you listen. Peter, in some way or other, despoiled that man's power to listen to the word of the Lord. And Jesus restored his power to listen to the word of truth. I think that all these miraculous healings should be interpreted that way. And after all, it is a far more useful, and I presume to say intelligent, way of interpreting these sayings. Now, that's what was said by the living Jesus when he started his ministry. The risen Christ, the Son of God. Jesus was the Son of Man. Man means mind. He was the Son of Mind. Now, the risen Christ, the Son of God, says to the 11, there are no longer 12, there are 11 only now, after Judas led the way to Jesus and the others. Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, but he that believeth not shall be damned. It's not that the person who doesn't believe will be damned for not believing the particular presentation of the truth. Because Jesus presented it in his way. He that believeth. What does belief in this context really mean? What do you think it means? Does it mean believe in the same way as somebody comes and gossips? Did you know Mrs. Rumpelstiltskin, this, that, and the other? Oh, yes, she told me so, and then this one tells somebody else. And I do believe Mrs. Rumpelstiltskin, because she's very sound, and so forth. Does it mean believe in that sense? To believe is to be faithful to. The word leaf, L-I-E-F, I think has that meaning. It has been used with that meaning in poetry. So to believe means to be devoted to be loyal to. That's it. The idea of the liege lord, for example, the liege lord. You give your faith, you give your trust unto the liege lord, even with your very life. So belief, in the profound sense, to me at least, means that. So he that believeth in me, as Jesus said. That means that whosoever has that trust and fidelity shall be saved. Saved means salved, healed, made whole. Doesn't mean saved from drowning or anything like that. So, we have not only the injunctions, but we also have the mandate given by the great teachers. And that finishes that chapter. We come now to chapter 5, which is headed Communion. You all have a copy of this book, have you? All the world is in communion. It's a statement like that, you might well say, is it? don't see any evidence of it, but it is a fact. For communion is relationship, and everything exists in relationship with everything else, willy-nilly. Whether one is aware of it or not, whether one wishes to be in relationship or not, the fact, the actual fact of the manifested universe is that every single thing is in relationship with every other living thing, every other single thing throughout the universe. Whether it be an atom or a virus, whether it be a saint or a sinner. But there is complete relationship. And the whole human race, ever since it became, grew into the human race some 3.5 million years ago, from evolving out of the primates, you see, the whole human race has been ignorant of that fact. And it still is, and it still insists on being ignorant. The mass of human beings live according to I am I and not you. I do this, I like this, I must have this, I want this, nothing to do with it. Deny the relationship. This is our ignorance, supreme ignorance, amounting to lunacy practically. And it often turns out criminal. Where and how does all the sorrow and misery, the problems, the conflicts and the cruelties of the world emanate? I and thou, two separate creatures. But if I am awake to the fact that I am you, you are me, we are just different versions of each other, then there would be a profound, not only psychological relationship, but a relationship in which one has awakened to truth. Because this is at least the physical fact. And thank God for science that it stated this at the beginning of this century. That everything is in affects everything else. If you move an arm, I think it was Sir James Jeans in The Mysterious Universe who wrote that, it affects the furthest star. And the furthest star affects you in turn. If we are really awake to this, and it's not easy to awake to it, because the animal which has degraded into the state of the beast is so strong in us. You see? But if we awake to this, where would be all our quarrels, all our problems, wars and strikes and sanctions and God knows what not? But of course, the human race is hopelessly asleep. I mean, sleep like a dead drunk man is asleep. Intoxicatedly asleep, not healthily, happily asleep. Now, even as a man in profound slumber, that is dreamless sleep, rests in unknowing communion, so lives this intensely active universe. Look at the speeding galaxies keeping tryst, or colliding cataclysmically in preparation for new emergence. You see, things which apparently hurt us, or seem to hurt us, we discard. But why? If the galaxies, if there wasn't the Big Bang and that terrific explosion of the entire universe, which had just become a pinpoint. The entire universe of matter was a pinpoint in size, and the internal pressures and temperatures were so tremendous. You can't. The brain absolutely boggles. The calculated temperature was 10 to the power 31 degrees. One with 31 noughts after it. A little hot, you know. And the pressure was 10 to the power 90 kilograms per square centimeter. We sustain a pressure, our bodies sustain a pressure on the planet, of 15 pounds per square inch. It's the same pressure from within the body outwards, that's why we don't burst. You see, it balances the atmospheric pressure. When you go sufficiently high up, you start bleeding, because the atmospheric pressure is so low that the internal pressure is that much greater, and therefore you start bleeding. You see. Now, imagine a pressure not of 15 pounds per square inch upon you, but a pressure of 10 to the power 90 kilograms upon you. And of course the Big Bang took place, and the universe is still speeding away, so many galaxies. So things which seem to be terrible and horrible, volcanoes, earthquakes and all the rest of it, to come just within our own planet again, the sphere of our own planet, they all have their place, they all have a cause, there is good reason for it, and the reason is good, because it is true, that is all. It's not pleasant. Our great difficulty as human organisms is that we want only that which is pleasant, which is pleasurable. We are the slaves of sensation. But if we can see things as a whole and understand from the holistic point of view, from the holistic view, you see, all this would disappear. We can then cooperate naturally. We won't have to think of cooperating. We won't have to say, oh, no, I mustn't be against my neighbor. I must work in harmony with him. You won't have to think it. You will just do it naturally. You can't help it. Look at the speeding galaxies. Look at the speeding galaxies keeping tryst or colliding cataclysmically in preparation for new emergence. See the stars in their courses spelling out life's story, or suns encircling earths in intimate play, bringing forth nurslings of immortality. That is us. We are the nurslings of immortality, if we only knew. And that is just due to the fact that the sun and the earth are in this particular relationship. Without the sun, without the earth, and all that happens here in consequence, and we wouldn't be to start with. Is not that high peak in communion with highest sky? I remember very well when traveling in Kashmir, seeing Nanga Parbat, 26,000 feet. The last 5,000 feet of Nanga Parbat is just one solid cone of snow, ice and snow. And it's an extraordinary sight. And especially, I was lucky, I had a lovely blue sky day and a brilliant sun. This was July, end of July, August, and beginning of August 1934. And really, a sort of experienced what communion means, seeing that sight. That hard headland with the surging sea surrounding it, all this roaming river with its bed and banks, both the moving and the unmoving are in communion. The atom's vibrant nucleus with its attendant electrons, and the speechless furniture with the motionless room. If you like sometimes to sit in your own room quietly, just look at the furniture, look at the walls, feel the roominess, the roominess of the room, and become aware of the communion of it all, together with oneself. It's quite extraordinary. I've done these things. In endless variety, the play of life holds hidden revelation. The flower is in communion with the stalk from which it hangs, the falling leaf with the wind which makes it dance, the maiden with her lover, and the mother with her babe. Quiet pigeons on a jutting ledge commune with the night, and the stars speak with each other in the pulsing dark and utter wisdom to the listening ear, while the trees, which swayed with laughing gladness in the day, now rest in silent worship, and man communes with woman. Up till the word silent worship from quiet pigeons was the result of a marvelous evening in Bombay. Quiet pigeons are sitting on a jutting ledge and so forth. This was in 1967, I think. Yes. But just as there is the communion which is beauty and joy, there is also the communion of terror and pain and death. The lion's jaw with the antelope's neck, the live bull's head with the senseless abattoir, the executioner's sword with the soft, full-blooded throat. It's a communion of terror and horror, but it is there. And the redemptive communion of Socrates with his cup and Jesus with his cross. The familiar harmonies of daily zest fill our lifespan. The cook communing with his salt, and the carpenter with his wood, the pianist with his piano, and the scholar with his book. And also some strange and tortuous things we see when the clock communes with anxiety and time with sorrow. And does not the devil commune with God, the practicing saint with his lust, and the zealous saver of souls with evil? All the world is in communion, fed with sacrifice, the great sacrifice which is the ever-turning wheel of universal becoming. Through him who is whole and pure, the world awakens out of unknowing communion into perfect communion. The world does not know it, but he is a light. In the darkness, he is the light of the world, and his awakened state is the timeless communion of the nameless unknown with all the world. Through him, the star of truth, the heart of love. To be thus is man's religious fulfillment. being in communion, this is the heart of religion.